Saunders?
Good afternoon. My name is Patty Saunders. I'm the acting executive director for Trustees for Alaska. I testified about this several times and refer you to my earlier testimony in front of other committees, and I'm going to be limited today. My basic point today is that clean water is a right that belongs to every citizen of Alaska individually and collectively. What this bill would do is change the privilege to pollute into the right to pollute, to the detriment of the right of the citizens of Alaska to clean water. In addition to that, it is contrary in several very important respects to the mandates of the Federal Clean Water Act. Mr. Eaton alluded to several of them previously. I'd like to add to that list. In the first place, by making them mandatory, you would be in conflict with the requirement of the Clean Water Act to employ technology that makes it possible to meet effluent limits at the end of the pipe. Furthermore, you're shifting the burden from the polluter to the state to prove injury to health or the environment of only several limited types. And by limiting it to toxic pollutants as opposed to all pollutants, which are regulated by the Clean Water Act, you seriously impair the ability of the state to meet the mandates of the Clean Water Act. Furthermore, the sentence in the middle of the bill, which purports to overturn or overrule EPA's regulations is, of course, a violation of federal law, and I'm not quite sure what the attempt is or what the intent is of that law. Finally, I'd like to state that perhaps one of the most critical failures with respect to the Clean Water Act is the absence of the word attainable to modify the word uses. The Clean Water Act requires the protection of both existing and attainable uses, and that is clearly not included in its bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Patty. Rex Blazer?
Rex has deferred to me. If I can go next, if that's all right. My name is Randy Rogers.
You were next on the list. Go ahead, sir.
Thank you. As I said, my name is Randy Rogers, Box 82215, Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm speaking on behalf of myself. I'm opposed to HB 524 for several reasons, the first of which is that I feel that the mixing zone as it's currently used is working in many instances, and there's quite a bit of data available, especially in the 40-mile area where there's good volumes for mixing ratios, that the current mixing zone has allowed several operators to attain full compliance with water quality standards. I think that the current situation where the miner needs to come into DEC and provide the data on flow ratios, mixing ratios, in order to determine if the mixing can still result in compliance with state water quality standards is the proper method. It's going to cost DEC a big bundle of money, as pointed out by Mr. Easton earlier, to go ahead and compile all this data and, if necessary, defend that data in court or in some evidentiary hearing against assertions of miners who don't agree with a particular determination on a mixing zone. I feel that the fiscal cost of the state is unacceptable given the current situation with DEC's budget. You can't expect the agency to do more with less money. You've got to fund these things if you're going to do them. The likely result of passage of this law is further confusion over what the water quality standards are, who needs to comply with them, who can get around complying with them, and so that you're not necessarily going to help clear things up for the mining industry, and that in the long run you're looking at increased litigation over water quality at a point in time when EPA is just about to come out with its National Effluent Guidelines, which may help provide a little bit of certainty to this industry. Also, regardless of what the state does here with mixing zones, it's not going to remove the EPA end-of-pipe standards, and those standards will still have to be enforced to the same effect, and maybe the enforcement will take place by EPA instead of DEC. Nevertheless, it is not going to do anything to realistically help the miners. So I would like to see us concentrate on looking at ways to develop regulations that may enhance the use of mixing zones right now, but stick to the general parameters of the mixing zones, which limit them to a certain size and require the right solutions for mixing so that they can be used and still protect water quality at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. It's 4 o'clock, so we're going to have to get out of here in just a few seconds. I don't know if Mr. Frank, you wanted to make any closing remarks here. I guess one of the questions that came up was whether or not it's legal to exceed the regs the EPA put forth, and I think that you've already touched on that, but maybe you could talk on that again.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, I don't claim to be, I'm not an attorney, I don't claim to have a ultimately know from a legal standpoint the Clean Water Act, but the EPA has approved in the last 2 years 70 permits for to exceed the effluent guidelines based upon the volume of water the receiving water. So, frankly, I don't understand when they say that it doesn't meet the Clean Water Act. I don't understand why it doesn't, Mr. Chairman. Although it may have something to do with best achievable techniques or something like that. I'm not sure.
Okay, I don't know if there's anybody else in the audience that's here that isn't going to be here the rest of this week that feels like they have to say something right now. I already spoke with Representative Frank about whether or not this bill can move. We aren't going to be able to move it right now. The co-chairman isn't here. It may well be that people on the committee feel they need more information, but I'm going to ask my staff to get with you and see if we can maybe just go through the questions that have been raised and see if we can't get a better understanding of the difference between what EPA might require and what the state might be allowed to do. So that's the only question that kind of lingers with me. Is there anything else that the committee wants to bring up? Yes, Mr. Springer.
You want to combine the Hunter harassment and the minor harassment bill into one?
it might work.
You holding it over till tomorrow?
Thank you to the people who participated in the testimony today. We're adjourned. Call me in order. Apparently we're on the teleconference, so use your mics. This is what's the date today? May 4th, this is the House Resource Committee. President members Cotton, Herman, Springer, Hoffman, Sund, and Navarre. The intention of the committee this morning is to finish the work on Senate Bill 112 and then go into the ag package. I think there's two bills in the committee and a third on its way, so I wanted this morning to make sure that we got all the issues on the table as far as the debt restructuring, the issues involving the creamery, and further consideration for the Senator Tulip's bill to increase the size of the board. Lisa, you want to join us at the table? We can attempt to finish the work on Senate Bill 112. We still have some pending amendments, is that correct?
Yes.
So you should have a new CS in front of you that incorporated the amendments that were adopted yesterday, is that correct? And what have we got? How many more we have?
Five
more amendments, all right. So why don't you walk through here? Number one is the why don't you go ahead and explain what you've got there?
The director, my name is Lisa Weiss, staff to Representative Sam Cotton and the House Resources Committee. Amendment number one is the intent language that the Mat-Su Borough has proposed. There are two options here. One is to put delete the intent that is there now since it's been incorporated into the bill and insert it into this new language, into that intent section, or simply delete the original intent and put this language into the purpose section, retaining what is in the purpose section now.
Okay, now we've got, now that's, so you've got once. What's the difference here between the first and the second?
There's nothing different, it's just where we put it. Whether it is in the intent, put it under intent language or under the purpose section.
You know, the other thing I'm thinking about is whether or not we ought to say at the least public expense. I'm not sure what the... Did you have a question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm not going to support an intent that says that we should manage our resources at the least public expense. I don't know what that means.
I think it's part of, I think I understand what the intent there was. Was it that we would transfer some of the actual dollar cash outlay cost, but I'm not sure that that phrase belongs in here. Otherwise, I feel fairly comfortable that we do want the commonly owned multiple resources associated with forest lands be managed for maximum sustained yield consistent with best management practice.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I don't really understand the need for this whole intent section. If you just go through, it's the intent of the legislature that commonly owned multiple resources associated with forest lands, well, that's bear, deer, animals, subsistence, all of the resources that we have in the forest, including wilderness, be managed for maximum sustained yield. That's probably right out of the Constitution. But then you get into least public expense by creating a system of public ownership, private management. I don't really understand the need for making that kind of an intent statement at all.
Well, just for the purpose of discussion, I'd move that we delete Section 1 of the bill. And I won't offer any other intent language. I don't know what. Is there any discussion on that? We can start out by deleting that. As Ms. Weisler's pointed out, that's been incorporated into the body of the bill. Is there objection to deleting the intent language? Anybody else have any intent language they want to offer? Okay.
Yeah. Okay, number 2 does just delete the intent
language. All right. Then number 3. This is the so-called concurrence issue. Okay. We're ready to vote on this issue. Looks like we've got 3 people missing. Amendment number 3 would delete the concurrence and insert after consultation with the on page 2, line 13, line 15, and page 9, line 1. Page 2, line 13 and 15 deals with the initial agreement, and okay, that just cleans it up on line 15 to take out the consultation. Apparently, the Mattsu boroughs backed off on their idea of concurrence before the agreements could be signed. And on page 9, line 1, that must be the extension. There again, it would be consultation rather than concurrence if the amendment's adopted. So, anybody want to move the amendment?
I'm moving.
All right. Motion's on the table. Is there any discussion? Those in favor of the amendment? There's 6. Those opposed? Madam Chairman. The minority, that amendment has been adopted. All right, can we go through amendment number 4 with us?
Amendment number 4 attempts to address the question of legislative approval of credit. We have before you a statement from Cam Cook of our Legal Services Division explaining what the problem is. If a credit is truly appropriation, it has to go through the entire legislative process. Approval can't be delegated to a committee or a portion of the legislature. If it's truly not an appropriation, then the state does not have to come to the legislature for approval. You get into separation of powers if you try to do that. The language that you have before you relates to what they do with program receipts, where the Budget and Audit Committee will give its recommendation on a credit. It has 45 days to approve or disapprove, or, well, 45 days can elapse before the credit is granted unless they recommend before that time that it be granted. If they recommend that the commissioner not grant the credit, and the commissioner must review the credit again, if they decide to go ahead and grant it, then they must come back or write a statement to the commission, to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, explaining why the credit is made.
All right, so for the purpose of discussion, I'd move amendment number 4. This is a pretty standard procedure with the Budget and Audit Committee, and I believe that we had Bradley and Uttermole writing this, so they must agree that at least it's legal.
It is legal. I did speak with George Udemol this morning. There's a question with all of these types of things, whether it's an actual legal requirement that the state actually go through this process. But that's something that's been in debate for many years.
Well, how did the discussion go, and how it was determined whether it was an appropriation or not?
Pardon?
Who determines it? How is it determined whether or not it's an appropriation?
I think if the committee should decide it's an appropriation, then it must go through the entire legislative process.
Yes, so there, at least the legislature gets exposure here.
Yes.
If they decide it's an appropriation, they can make whatever action they want at that point. Is there other discussion on Amendment Number 4? Is there objection to Amendment Number 4? All right, it's adopted. Okay, Amendment Number 5. This was the other question that was raised by the Matt Sue Burrow that suggested that in place of a management plan, the private contractor could submit a master plan, and if it was accepted by the commissioner, then it would be allowed in lieu of a management plan. I don't intend to offer this, but that's, again, it's on the table because it was requested by the Matt Sue Burrow. Anybody want to offer the amendment? Apparently not. So I think we have, so any other amendments? There are two people here that want to testify on it, so we can just take a couple minutes for them. Mr. Smith is here too. I don't know if you've got any comments you want to offer the committee. Okay, Kate, did you want to join us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Kate Graham. I'm the Executive Director of United Fishermen of Alaska. We remain extremely concerned about this bill, and we are particularly concerned in light of the amendment that the committee's just passed. I understand that the department has said that they do not need to concur in these agreements. My group, on the other hand, sees that as a statutory responsibility for adequate management of fisheries resources in the state. I have very, very deep concerns remaining that the Department of Natural Resources may perhaps overlook some of the necessary needs of the fisheries resources in their dealing with the timber resources, and that it is not built into the statute that the Department of Fish and Game is able to protect those.
Thank you, Kate. Yesterday, during our discussion, it was brought up that there are Title 16 permits and other permits that at least the Department of Fish and Game would have to approve in all likelihood, for a lot of the activity would be taking place out there. I guess I ended up being convinced that that was a pretty usable check that the department would have, in addition to their ability, as you know, we also discussed their ability to elevate disagreements to the Office of Government Coordination, and obviously the Commissioner of Fish and Game would always have access to the governor to ask for intervention. So I guess I ended up feeling uncomfortable with the concurrence, and comfortable with the fact that there were other channels and avenues that DEC and Fish and Game would have in order to get their points of view to the highest level.
Mr. Chair, those mechanisms apparently work okay, generally speaking, but they do it on a case-by-case basis. It's sort of a spot check sort of a thing. It doesn't make sense when you're talking of an overall plan, an overall agreement that will then go forward for a number of years. This is not a one-shot deal we're talking about. This is a number of years that timber is going to be harvested. It only makes sense that the affected agencies will have their work already partly done in the determination of how that timber harvesting will be carried out. And then that makes the issuance of the permits relatively simple. This is what I'm suggesting is essentially a time-saving measure. And it would be good for the contractor in the first place, it seems to me, to know up front exactly what kinds of concerns the Department of Fish and Game, as well as DEC and the other affected agencies, including the local governments, will have about that operation. They'll know right off the bat. They'll be able to plan ahead for those things and not have to run this gamut of agency approval every single time they need another permit. That doesn't make sense, and it doesn't make sense for the adequate management of the other resources of that area.
Thank you, Kate. Are there other questions for committee members? There is not. Thank you. And I think, John, did you want to offer some other remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do both of these mics have to be on?
No.
My name is John Ducker. I'm representing myself. It's a little hard to aim at a shifting target here, but I guess the intent language that is in the May 3rd draft is no longer there. And I thought I heard a reference by staff to the fact that the intent for small operators to be provided for was now within the body of the bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you identify that section on that.
I haven't been able to find that. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think what may have been created here is a situation in which it is possible for the commissioner to set up a timber industry structure where there are small operators as defined in the definition section, that is people who hire less than 25 full-time equivalents, and the FMA holder, him or herself, and nobody in between. I'm not sure that small is the point of my concerns, in that I think what's really needed is that somehow the FMAs be restricted to a size within a region so that the region's ability to continue to provide forest products for itself and to develop its import replacement industry be protected, since the FMAs very likely will be either export operations or timber product, forest product production operations that bear no relationship to the local market. If they are of a size that the local industry or another industry cannot develop to supply its own market, then that region will, for the term of the agreement at least, be unable to develop. And I think some prior planning in the FMA planning process has to go into determining just how many board feet per year is required of net accessible timber for the existing industry and for any potential industry that might develop for import replacement purposes. And that those purposes might be served, and that local industry and import replacement industry might be filled by operators who have more than 25 employees and in fact might be quite large. In areas such as the interior Alaska, there have been forest products plans of various kinds which envision replacing the currently imported framing lumber with local products, using pellets and chips to fuel utilities for electric and heat generation in municipalities and military installations. Any number of schemes have been floated, and desires exist in those regions to develop the forest product industries along those lines. There's no assurance in the planning process here other than reference to social, economic, and environmental planning and that sort of thing, that those things would be protected. I may be missing something. I don't see a prohibition against the FMA holder from bidding on off FMA sales. They're precluded from bidding on timber sales that are less than 5 million board feet. I'm not sure why it wouldn't be preferable to simply prohibit the FMA holder from bidding on off FMA timber sales, period, regardless of size, especially since there are frequent and regular opportunities for renegotiation of the FMA, which I assume includes the annual allowable cut in the boundaries. I think another important thing to consider is that the cost of expenditures for stumpage credits have to have some means of verification. There is no requirement in this bill for some sort of open books provision, although that may exist elsewhere in law, I'm not sure. But that as competition decreases with increasing concentration of the industry in the region, the FMA holders' books are going to become less reliable as an indicator of actual costs, and as comparative data from competition becomes scarcer. So I think stumpage credit cost verification is going to become a very big problem with FMAs. And of course, it's not only at the stage of determining what the credits should be that this becomes a problem. It's also a problem during the negotiation process, because the commissioner is not going to be able to determine whether the state is getting a good deal or not unless he or she knows what the approximate costs are of the silvicultural operations being required and other things that are being required in the FMA agreement. Let's see, has a controlled by contract provision a definition for small operator being retained here, Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It has. We'll comment on that. I think another important provision to include in an FMA bill, similar to a provision that the FMA not be so large as to preclude other local forest product industries from developing, is that when a production facility is to be a provision of an FMA, that its maximum capacity should not really be allowed to exclude that region's net annual allowable cut minus the timber volume that the region itself requires for its own needs. And that cannot, of course, be stipulated in statute except by requiring it to be considered in planning. But that is not stipulated in the requirements for planning as the bill now reads. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, sir. Are there questions? Apparently not. Are there others who feel that they need a chance to talk on this? Yes, please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Cheryl Sutton, and I'm representing the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Cooperative. And we're real concerned with the amendment adopted this morning, which will delete with concurrence and add after consultation with. We feel that in order to have sound forest management practices, it's absolutely essential that there be concurrence with all the agencies affected in the management of other resources in these areas. And as you well know, Title 16 gives authority to the Department of Fish and Game only to the water column and not to the critical habitat areas beyond the water column. And we've had on the Kenai Peninsula, for instance, the Kenai River, and have a very big problem at present because There is nothing in place to protect critical habitat adjacent to the Kenai River. And we have development that's unbridled at this point, and it's now down to a borough level. And whether or not we'll have safeguards in place remains to be seen. But in particular reference to the Susitna drainage, you have 19,000 square miles of drainage. You have at least six anadromous streams, major anadromous streams, with no protection beyond the water column from the Department of Fish and Game standpoint for the protection of fish and wildlife. So we think it's absolutely essential that DNR have concurrence from the other departments involved in management resources in those areas and not just consult with them.
Okay, thank you. You may be aware that there's another piece of legislation that addresses those six anadromous streams. I'm pretty hopeful it's going to pass too. So, are there other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Mr. Abbott.
Mr. Chairman, we'll be very brief, but there's a section of the bill on page 5. It's on line 9. It's section 13, or subsection 13. And it's a preclusion of a contractor under an FMA from bidding on sales of less than 5 million feet. We understand the concerns that this section was designed to satisfy, but it may in fact be a little bit superficial at this point. It's conceivable, and matter of fact, it's likely in the near future, if DNR goes on in its present work plan, that it may in fact offer FMAs that are smaller than 5 million feet in and of themselves, certainly in terms of annual cut. And it might be appropriate to, if it's the desire of the committee, to preclude operators of large regional sized FMAs from bidding on small sales, to in fact perhaps set a size of an FMA under which or over which an operator could not then bid on small sales in the same region. But if, for instance, FMAs are put together from Marmot Island or some of the areas that they've been discussed, which are relatively small and self-contained, it may not be appropriate to preclude an operator of a small FMA like that from bidding on nearby smaller sales also without having a dominant regional impact or an overwhelming market impact vis-a-vis the other smaller operators in the area. So if the committee was interested in satisfying this concern, they could set a limit of a minimum size of an FMA, which if an FMA operator was greater than or was cutting more than that on an annual basis, he would not be allowed to bid on small sales in the same area. But if someone was working a smaller FMA, the preclusion wouldn't impact them. That's our concern, Mr. Chairman, and it's one that we were unaware of until we saw the CS this morning, and we would have brought it to your attention sooner than we did.
Mr. Melfi, did you have any comments on that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Frank Melfi from the Department of Natural Resources. There's a couple different ways about three different ways you could limit it. One, you could say only for FMAs that are larger than 5 million board feet a year, or you could limit regionally, or you could take all the language out and just insert some language such as the commissioner shall impose limitations on the operator's eligibility to compete in subsequent timber sales and FMAs to ensure supply of timber for other operators. And that might be better to do that instead of working with regions that may not be well defined or volumes that we don't understand so well. If I had to make a recommendation, it would be for the last one.
Yeah.
Well, I guess my concern here is this title of this bill is forest management agreements and not sale management agreements. And I just have a perception of what we're trying to do here, that if you offer an FMA up that's less than 5 million board feet and tell the guy to harvest it on a sustained yield basis, I'm not sure how much you can cut every year. You can probably cut all the down the whole allowable cut for that year on a 100-year rotation in about
You're talking
acres.
Less than 500 acres there, so I think. And then, we figured 500,000 was about maybe 50 acres.
I don't know what the volume's up there. A good stand down here is 50,000 board feet to the acre, and a bad stand is 20,000 board feet to the acre. I think that's a marginal economic standard.
What do we use for standard up there?
I believe it's about 12 is average.
12,000 board feet per acre.
1,200, Mr. Chairman. 1,200 cubic feet, 1,236 is the average for the Susitna plant.
That's cubic feet.
About 4 cubic feet, 4 board foot per cubic feet. You're talking 5,000 an acre.
5,000 board feet per acre. So I guess there's a conception here that is missing on me somewhere, that if you get these, quote, FMAs so small, and you're going to do each FMA on a sustained yield basis, then I don't understand what we're doing.
Yeah, so that in that case, it'd be 1,000 acres, which is unlikely. It seems, I don't know if you, what your opinion is, but it seems unlikely to me that an FMA would be as small as 1,000 acres.
That would be extremely unlikely. The only thing I could think of is perhaps a firewood cutter, but even, you know, can you expect a firewood cutter to do regeneration and all that?
I think we're designing the forest. You sell the timber to them. And the state manages the timber like they ought to manage the timber, you know, on a sustained yield basis in a large regional sense. But it was my concept here that we were talking about large areas that require massive amounts of infrastructure, massive amount of capital investment by the operator, and they have to have a large area of timber over a long period of time to justify that kind of expenditure. So I don't see the problem.
Well, we could put it back in subcommittee.
Mr. Chairman, do you want me to address Mr. Sutton's concerns there?
Yeah, if you'd like to.
Basically, we are going into an area what we've never done here. We've looked at what some other jurisdictions have done, such as British Columbia, and we are not envisioning any small ones, but how small is small? We look at Marmot Island, which I believe has, I think it's got 12,000 acres or so on it. We might be looking at that as an FMA.
Yeah, but Marmot Island would have more than 1,200 board feet per cubic feet per acre, or it's more like the southeast.
Yeah, more like a little bit, probably about like ICK, not quite like southeast, but more like Prince William Sound.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I would just point out that I would be extremely shocked if somebody didn't come back in the next year or two and ask for a fairly substantial rewrite of this piece of legislation. And I think there's other areas in here people may have trouble with, but this is one that could come back in the form of a request to change.
All right. So apparently there's no other amendments being offered there. I know we've got Representative Herman had a letter of intent here that she wanted to offer for some additional work in this area anyway that I don't know if you wanted to offer that at this point. Has to do with maybe I can just turn it, I'll turn the floor over to you, but it discusses that the legislature would also intend that the Forest Practices Act get a good review between now and next session of the legislature with the idea in mind that some changes might want to be made to that, and perhaps this as well. And Representative Herman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What it says is it is the intent of the legislature in passing Senate Bill 112, and I don't know if the wording is correct, but to encourage the governor to have a task force look at the Forest Practices Act. So it doesn't mandate him or anything, and as we know, intent is not does not have the force of law. The task force should include representatives from the timber industry, fishing groups, and environmental groups, staff from the Departments of Fish and Game, Natural Resources, and Environmental Conservation. Should work with the task force on the Forest Practices Act. And from what I saw with this issue, you know, I don't think that any of the groups are getting any closer together. And if we're going to have any kind of development, any kind of protection of our resources, you know, some people should start getting together, should get to the table, and should agree to disagree. And, you know, I mean, it comes to our level, and we're just always at, you know, on one side or the other. And it's got to start at other levels to start coming to different agreements. And, you know, I still think that the groups are just miles apart. So I would like, you know, I know that there was a timber task force created before, and I'm not sure exactly what came out of that task force, but I don't think they looked at the Forest Practices Act. I think the Forest Practices Act, the concern there is with the, you know, I think Fish and Game has like two stipulations there, and maybe they should have more. Maybe they need to look at what exactly the powers of the coastal zone management and things like that. So I think that if we do pass the bill, that we should pass the letter of intent. Thank you.
Okay, I'd ask unanimous consent we adopt the letter of intent. Is there objection? Okay, the letter of intent's been adopted. I move that we adopt the committee substitute that incorporates the additional changes that we made today. Ask unanimous consent. All right. I move we pass the bill out of committee. We've picked up a few fiscal notes, and I think it's got a finance referral anyway. So they'll just travel with it. We're done. All right. We're going to go into agriculture now, and there's three bills that the committee has. Three bills that the committee has that we're going to need to deal with, and one of them isn't even in the committee yet. I'll take a minute here to let people that want to leave, leave. You can do it. Just have a look, everybody take a look at Senate Bill 309 here. At some point this morning we'll try to take that up and deal with it, but there's a couple people that want to be here before we do it. Fairly straightforward. Why don't you pass that out right now? Yes, we adopt the letter of intent. The letter of intent for travel. Have we already had a hearing on the
Yeah.
Yeah.
We've had hearings on the two bills, so I don't think we're going to be able to take any final action today, but I want to get this 484 in front of this. This is probably the most important of the three bills, the restructuring bill. I'd like to get that issue on the table in front of the committee today. And this afternoon, we can meet again this afternoon and perhaps even tonight. It's really important that we get a decision made on all three of these pieces of legislation. The third one is not even in the committee yet. It'll be in later today. It's Senate Bill 484. We just had it passed out here.
What's the section?
Pardon me?
I'm missing. Yeah. 472.
484, yeah. The other one's 292. Is that one of Cthulhu's that expands the board, puts two more farmers on it?
I have that. It's not out. That's
yeah,
right.
That's...
That's going to be up at 3:30.
Yeah, we can bring that up later. But so what we're having here, we don't have Senate Bill 484 in front of us, but we can have the bill that the Senate passed, and we can have the department and proponents and opponents of the different sides of the issues get the issues on the table here this morning. And I don't see, I thought that, where did the DNR go? Oh, okay. So you're going to speak for the Department of Natural Resources?
Yes.
Okay, please join us.
Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund. I'm here to discuss and answer any questions you might have regarding Senate Bill 484, the provisions that are contained in that bill with respect to how our restructuring program has worked to date and what we've done.
Well, it's my understanding that the administration wants to have Senate Bill 484 passed. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. So maybe you can tell us why you think you need a bill and which provisions in this bill you like, don't like, what ought to be here that isn't here. Maybe you could walk us through hitting the high points.
Okay. On this bill, beginning at the section one, item D. There's a clause to include a financial analyst for the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund. I don't exactly know what that position would be. It seems rather difficult for the loan board to administer a personnel position, hire, fire, do that kind of work. I know there's a fiscal note of about $74,000 to $82,000 in that range for that position. The the loan fund that operates now operates with a loan manager, loan examiner, fund accountant, and accounting clerks, and that pretty well takes care of the operation.
What's the thinking that's, so the department opposes that language?
I think the department finds that it's not necessary to hire or supervise for the loan board. It's difficult. We could probably use another employee, but it's difficult the way this is written for a loan board to hire, administer, supervise a employee in a supervisory bargaining unit. This loan board meets once a month for 1 or 2 days and basically doesn't see that individual again for another month. And so,
okay, so all the staff now, all the employees that the Department of or the Division of Agriculture work for the director.
We work for the director. Yeah.
Right. So then if the board wanted to, so I guess the point is if the board wanted to hire somebody, then that person would answer to the board rather than to the director. Is that right?
That's correct. In the past, the board at times has contracted with financial analysts, for example, when Point McKenzie was in just starting up and some of the farms had just started to milk out there. They hired an analyst, a dairy specialist from Minnesota to take a look at the operations and assist the farmers and the board to make recommendations on how they could improve the operations out there. So the board already has the ability to hire a specialist trained in certain specific areas to bring them in if they so desire and want to spend the money. They looked at doing that 2 years later and decided not to do it again based on the similarity of information they started getting in on all the operations. They didn't think it was worth the expense at that point.
So they can contract right now?
Yes, they have contracted in the past.
All right.
But it looks like a one-time contract for a specific service that's highly specialized that staff might not have time to do what I'm doing.
But is their contracting authority limited then?
I don't know if it's limited or not. I don't know how long they could extend the contracts. I think if we looked at a long-term contract, then we would be involved in the budget process.
Which money do they have at their disposal?
The part of the money that we set aside annually for the operating budget loan fund is contractual services. And when we when this was set up before, we programmed in our budget for contracting for this person to come up, and then the loan board reviewed the individual's qualifications, decided what they wanted done, and had the person come in. But it was a joint effort handled by the board and the Division of Agriculture.
So, but does the board have dollars at its disposal now, discretionary dollars?
Not discretionary dollars outside of our operating budget, which allows for contractual.
And so how,
for example,
I don't want to dwell too much longer on this, but it just seems sort of unusual to give a board the ability to hire somebody but then still require the Executive Budget Act to take to control the situation.
I believe the thinking there is to not let them get out of control, to keep it within a certain dollar range within our operating budget.
Okay. All right. Any other questions on that part of it? You want to go ahead and continue on through the building.
The department, Section E of the bill allows for payments of 2 percentage points per year of interest due on agricultural loans. If the loans are in good standing and if those loans have not been restructured, rewritten, rolled over, modified in any other way, it does not affect a great number of our borrowers. It affects about $9 million worth of the loan funds. So the only problem that I have in terms of this particular section is simply an operational problem of carrying a separate set of loan accruals for a group of people that pay their loans. We already have a system now whereby people are they pay a penalty if they do not pay on time. It's a little easier to administer, but the department does not oppose this particular section particularly. It's a little more work, but does provide a benefit to some of the borrowers that have and recognition that they've been making more of an effort than a major portion of them to pay on time.
What's the difference between this and the bill you had in was on production credits? So is this the same theory here? What kind of credits are you talking about?
Well,
all you're saying is that if the person makes his payment on time, you're going to give them a break?
Well, that's what happens. If they pay on time, instead of paying 8%, the interest would be accrued 6% on that note for the period of the payment, be it monthly or annual.
I guess I understand that. Go ahead.
Section G provides for the Agricultural Revolving Loan Fund to, in specific language, to foreclose and sell, dispose of property arising out of our national loan process. We, in our statute, do not have specific authority as is involved in some of the other programs, the Commerce and Economic Development. So this language is included so that it was specific that the Loan Fund Board, or the way this is written, the Director of Agriculture, could dispose of the property. We have been doing that right along. We have regular equipment sales, which has become a significant source of income revolving back the loan fund as we've picked up some abandoned farm equipment and had regular sales. The board has historically reviewed all of the sales of foreclosed property or lease agreements to make sure that they fit with the nature of agriculture, and their goal is, of course, to promote agriculture and agricultural production in the state. This language changes that a bit by having the director to dispose the property.
Okay, you're still in.
Yeah.
Well, now, the whole business about the creamery, would this give you do you need additional authority to dispose of property that you don't have now?
Oh, not really. We've been disposing of it. The ombudsman took a look at our procedures. They gave us some advice on revising how we sell. There's never been any problem with selling property, but the only reason this is in here is because specific legislation that Commerce and Economic Development programs have in their statutes provide for specific sale of property, and then they wrote regulations, and so we included this language to more clearly define the role of the loan fund and what we can do and what we can't do. As it operates now, the commissioner administers the loan fund together with the ARLF board, and this would modify that a bit because this changes it from the director to the director from the commissioner in terms of disposing the property.
Yeah. It changes from the commissioner to the director?
Yes. The way this is written, it's the director shall dispose.
But really, nothing changes if that section stays in or out, doesn't seem like to me.
Yeah. So, to the meat of it, section 2, restructure of agricultural debt. The reason that we want this program to be approved by the legislature, we started working on a restructure program about a year ago. Faced with 75% delinquency rates throughout the state in all agricultural areas. The first time I took a hard look at, everyone knows about the failure or alleged failure of the Delta area, and I took a look at delinquency rates for the Kenai area and found that they were exactly the same as Delta, and we decided that we needed to have a program that would provide restructuring of agricultural credits, provided they could cash flow within certain parameters, for the whole state, for the entire industry, as opposed to one particular group in one particular geographical location. So we had a lot of public hearings, took some input from the farm community during these public hearings, made some modifications to the program, adopted some guidelines. The AG took a look at it and said, well, looking at loan servicing that's done in national banks, state banks, it looks like you can go ahead and do this without legislation. We have last month received a review of that by the AG's office, which says get it in legislation. You don't have authority to restructure because your enabling statute is very specific in terms of what you can do for rewrites and renegotiation on operating chattel and farm development loans. So here we sit looking for a restructure bill which will allow us to modify terms and conditions of loans up to 30 years for farmers who can cash flow within certain parameters. It's not the position of the department to necessarily give everyone a restructured deal out there if they can't make payments or there's no way out of it. We don't want to do that. We've taken a middle ground attempting to assist those people that are in difficult financial straits that are kind of in the middle, and those people that are extremely well off financially. We've taken a page from the federal guidelines, which generally says you can restructure debt if you have a troubled debtor. Looking at all sources of revenue that the farmer may have, off-farm income and on-farm income, we consider that against the farm expense and his other expenses. If they're truly in financial trouble, cannot service the debt, then we have restructured their loan.
Can we stop you right there for a moment? I have a question.
You know, what's the maximum term of a ag loan now?
The maximum term set forth in the statute is 30 years on ag loan now.
Oh, it's 30 years?
Historically, we've written them to 25. We have not done any to maximum term.
Okay. And what's the, what does this mean? The maximum term of the loan modified under A of the section is 30 years from the date of restructuring. So you might have, so it might go how many years maximum?
The reason, the reason that language is stated that way is because we have had loans on the books for 8 or 10 years that are not performing. If we were to rewrite them under existing regulations, say a maximum term of 30 years, then we could give them 20 more or 21 more or maybe 19 more, depending on how long the credit's been there already. With this legislation, from the date of restructuring, once we roll this loan or group of loans into one new loan, we have a 30 maximum term of 30 years that we would go. So it kind of starts the process over to a maximum of 30.
Oh, okay. You said most of them go 25 in the next extension.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So in order to carry forward the program, it's necessary for the department to have legislative authority, statutory authority to restructure the credits. Section B allows for this restructuring up to a maximum of 30 years from the date we roll the loan over. It also, in Section C, number one, provides that that the borrower, if they accept this restructuring from the loan fund, there's a hold harmless clause that says, okay, we think you did this wrong, but we'll forgive you in the future for these past deeds. Section 2 requires the assignment of proceeds from the federal government programs, which is specifically conservation reserve and grain reserve and the peatland program. Those programs principally are used in the Delta area. There is one grower on Point McKenzie that signed up for the conservation reserve program. If the borrower is participating in those programs, this act, if adopted, would require that the proceeds go to the ARLF payments, all of the proceeds.
What's the scoop on those people? Someone told me that there's many people there, that's the only money that they've got coming in. Is that true in some cases?
In some cases, that's true.
So what's, if they have to turn all their money over, what's...
What our intent...
It seems like then they've got no income, and sure, their loan repayment schedule might get a little improvement.
We've done some workout situations with these people already, and what we do is when we restructure a loan, we restructure it so that it matches the source of repayment, and in some cases the borrowers get up to $50,000 a year and a restructured loan payment over a 10-year period, for example, because that's how long this money lasts from CRP, might be $33,000, $35,000, $20,000 a year, and so we would only take money sufficient to make the annual loan payment. Any excess funds would be turned back to the borrower. We obviously don't charge them more than we're due on the loan.
It isn't clear when you read number two.
Right, it's not. But that's in terms of getting down in the trenches and doing the work. You can't collect more money than is due on an individual loan payment, and so.
How would you feel about an amendment there that would say something like? Assignment of the proceeds necessary to meet the restructured debt payments.
That would be good. One of the problems here is that in the conservation reserve payment program, the payments by the federal government do not come in the form of a check. They come in the form of a certificate that's redeemable by the borrower only and not by the creditor. And so essentially the borrower has control of the money anyway, but I think an amendment, as you just
I don't want to foul it up. But I want to make sure that it's clear that they don't have to give you all the money if they don't owe you all the money.
Sufficient to cover the annual payment due on the debt or on the restructured loan. That's all we're looking for.
So let's see. On starting on line 18 here, that of course the operative is C, not withstanding any other provision, may approve an application for restructuring only if they satisfy those two conditions. And the first one is a release of everybody from potential liability and actions and omissions occurring before the date of restructuring, etc. So I assume that you expect to avoid litigation as a result of that section. Do you think you'll avoid all litigation?
I don't think we'll avoid all litigation.
Because some people won't want to restructure, is that the...
That's a hard one to read. They may not. They may feel that they have a strong enough case to litigate rather than restructure, but I don't. I really don't believe that they do have. And in terms of the rest of the bill and allowing them to have their federal program monies to repay their debt and restructure at a favorable rate, certainly under very favorable terms and conditions, it would be the rare individual that will litigate. But I'm sure there may be some that choose to do that.
Just on the whole question of whether restructuring can or cannot take place under current law, because I know that I met with some people here, the assistant AG, to talk about that. So maybe you could just, I'm not sure the rest of the committee's had the benefit of that discussion. Maybe you could just briefly outline what happened before, the volume of loans that were restructured, why the new opinion is that you can't restructure and you need legislation for that. I'm not sure the committee's heard all that.
Okay. The loan fund has approximately $30 million in non-performing loans. Again, a 75% delinquency rate out of a $40 million loan portfolio that's currently active. We have some 90 cases that have been referred to the AG's office statewide, the $30 million, basically. The restructuring program would allow us to modify the debt and not send every delinquent dollar out there off to the AG's office. Some of the $30 million we have there already are the basis are from charged-off loans that we had from 1986, and those loans, some of which had not had payments for 5 or 6 years and were reaching statute limitations, and I went through and charged off $9.8 million in the summer of 86 in order to start a collection process. The Attorney General came to work for us in December took a look at the restructuring program, took a look at the specific statutes that we have, and the statutes, enabling statutes, say that we can rewrite our short-term loans for a maximum of 3 years, that we can rewrite our chattel loans and do a one-year extension, that we can do certain modifications of payments. But those modification of payments are very specific and very short-term and don't do anything to solve our long-range problem. The restructuring program that we have proposed basically lumps the existing debt, including principal and interest, over a 20-year period and provides the debtor basically interest relief because they only pay interest on a portion of the debt each year. The AG's opinion basically says because the existing statutes are so specific that we don't have any general authority to modify the loans beyond what's existing in statute now. So it's imperative that we, if we are going to be able to modify and restructure anyone's debt out there, we need this legislation. We have approved 19 restructures to date based on what our policies and procedures that we set up. Six of those borrowers have closed their loans. We have with us, we completed the transaction, signed the documentation, and started making payments on the new program. It's about $6 million, I think. It's less than that, about $2 million, I think. And then we have a total of 19 that we've approved and for restructure. Some are refusing to sign because they don't like our documentation. Others are standing in line wanting the legislation to pass so they can sign on the dotted line and start making the payments.
Mr. Hoffman, that question.
Aside from a restructuring of the loans, what else is going to, in your opinion, going to change so that particularly the milk industry is going to turn around and this industry is going to turn around and we may get the $30 to $40 million back to make it a viable loan? It seems to me that even just by restructuring, we're not, you know, I know the industry is looking at diversifying their market, getting into yogurt and some other things, but it doesn't seem that there is a plan to make this whole industry viable in the state of Alaska. And why are we even pursuing it?
That's a good point. First of all, out of the loan portfolio that we have about $6.8 million that are involved in dairy loans at Point McKenzie directly out of the $30 million active portfolio we have. That portion is related to milk. The dairy industry has increased their productivity from, I believe, about less than 19 million pounds in 1985 to about 30 million pounds in 1987. We are at this time marketing nearly all of the milk. We just entered into a new marketing agreement with Standard of Alaska and their supplier, which will generate an additional $1 million in sales. The development, the redevelopment, I should say, of the dairy industry with the development of Point McKenzie has taken place in a very short period of time, given what normally happens in the agricultural industry and how long it takes. A five-year period isn't really long enough for it to shake out, starting in 1983 to 1988 in production. I think we're turning the corner for the sales and marketing right now with the entering into the agreements with Standard of Alaska. We're shipping milk to the North Slope now. We have shipped some to the bush, found it's not really possible, profitable, because it sometimes waits on a dock somewhere and we have no control of the product. I'm sure that will come. As you noted, we've entered into other product lines and we're looking at cheese right now to enhance the sales. The dairy farms on Point McKenzie and the three that are in the Matanuska Valley, we'll see some of those dairy farms out there not succeed on Point McKenzie. We'll see some do very well. We're already seeing that pattern. Some are extremely productive. They're meeting expectations of what they can do in some of the best dairies in the lower 48, and others will not make it. So this is an evolutionary process. It's probably one of a success story, I believe, but you're going to have failures and you're going to have successes in individuals, and it's a small program in terms of numbers. There are about 14 producers of milk in the state. Eight of those are on Point McKenzie. Of the eight, only one produces less than 30,000 pounds a year.
Follow up on that. In the restructuring then, are we improving our position regarding collateral, or if there are additional foreclosures, are we improving our chances to at least get something back?
Yes, that's correct. We've revised the collateral documentation for the loan fund, which includes new promissory notes, security agreements, deeds of trust, and financial statements. And the documentation, when completed, improves the collateral security position of the agricultural revolving loan fund, so that when and if there is a foreclosure, we have a better handle on what we have and a better legal position.
Go ahead, I'm sorry, Representative Pearson.
You said only one of the producers of Point McKenzie produces less than 30,000 pounds a year. Did you mean year or month?
Month, excuse me.
So all but one of the producers would fit under this bill at Point McKenzie?
Yes.
Okay. And one other question, if I could. On page 3, lines, the end of line 2 and the beginning of line 3, where it says, "and uses a majority of Alaska grain and forage," was that part of the original bill or was that added somewhere along the line?
I believe that was added on the floor of the Senate or sometime yesterday, and then that's particularly difficult to enforce, as you might imagine. And in fact, I believe imposes an unreasonable requirement on a farmer that's trying to maximize his income and minimize his expense.
It's fine with me if we say that you can't restructure it unless they use the majority of Alaska-grown grain and forage, but I guess my question is, what happens if the grain market happens to go to hell in a handbasket, it's too bad. I wouldn't want to see this tied to the farm, completely tied to the farmers, where we can bring some of these people down just because the grain, some of them are But it doesn't look like it ties in to the restructured, it doesn't tie into the next sentence, so I think it's the way it's, the way it's in the bill, it just tells you you can't restructure unless they presently use a majority.
I think that probably the most efficient producers on Point McKenzie, or for that matter the Massey Valley, buy a significant amount of their product from out of state right now because the corn prices, for example, are extremely low. They buy local feed, they buy local forage, but when you start feeding corn or other high energy feeds to your livestock and you can buy it dirt cheap, it doesn't make sense to pay a high price.
Mr. Sun, did we finish?
It's a matter of economics for the farmer.
I bet some corn in Illinois, I'll sell
it. On Alaska.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had the same questions that Representative Pierce asked, but I want to go back to page one, just so I understand this, that what we have in subsection E is the fact that because everybody who's doing badly is going to get their debt restructured, that we have to somehow encourage the people who aren't doing badly to give them a break beyond the deal that they originally signed. Right, so we're going to give them 2 points off of their interest rate. Is that kind of how that works?
That's kind of how that works, yeah.
If you do good, you get punished in the system because everybody who's doing badly is going to get a better deal. Well, yeah, and under this bill then, yeah. I just want to know how this works. Are I going to, so even the fish business now, if you had that same, you don't want to go out and encourage a lot of people to fail, because then if you could succeed, you could get your interest rates lower. Right? I mean, that's how this all operates.
Well, not exactly.
It looks like an incentive.
It's an incentive to, it's a payoff for not going broke.
Well, the other people, you know, the other people that do, if you know, restructure under some of the provisions of this bill, end up paying back less money because they can get a reduced interest rate. So, really, the state's giving up an asset.
Yeah.
So here you're. This is to provide for that person who did good that wasn't going to get the advantage.
Right. Yeah. I'm saying.
So you say you like that then?
Well, I just think it's kind of an interesting theory. You know, and it's the one that we're facing in Anchorage now, and a lot of those bank bailout issues and a lot of the other factors here, that the guy's gone bankrupt, and the issue is, do you go in and you bail him out? And the guy across the street who is, through good management, has struggled through and has made it, right? And somehow the guy across the street that was a bad businessman that went under gets bailed out, so he's on the street again competing against a guy who maybe made it but didn't really make it with that much margin, and now he's in an uncompetitive situation. So the guy that failed first is going to win in the end. And I've just said, generically said, no way, Jose. Right to make money in this country, and there's a right to go bankrupt in this country. And so, you know, this is a way to kind of accommodate that, I guess, to say that, okay, we're going to bail out the guy who went under, but not to the total detriment of the guy who didn't. So we, the state, because it's such a small pot here, we have the ability to go in and forgive the good guys too. We're in the macro sense of society, and we haven't even figured out how to do that. I just find it an interesting theory.
Mr. Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can appreciate some of the remarks of the representative Ketchikan, but I also think that certain times we're speaking of extenuating circumstances, and it's not always characterized as a generic bailout, but sometimes it's bail-in, because small businesses have the right to have some credit lines available too. And I think that that's one of the things that's overlooked. And I think this particular situation may be one of those extenuating circumstances. So while we may have the right to go broke and we may have the right to succeed, I think we also have a right to try to strike some middle ground so that the average person who's a hard worker and is trying to make a go of it and an honest go of it has an opportunity to survive too.
Well, Chairman, I would say the only reason that you could do this is because the state has total control over all the participants in this pool.
and that we can identify the losers and we can identify the winners and we can specifically reward them and not have to differentiate. The reason we have a hard time in big society is that we can't identify a program that picks out the winners and losers without benefiting people who don't need benefit and not rewarding those who went bankrupt. And other than giving a PFD check is about the only way we can do it. So this is the only way you can do it is in a specific program where you can identify all the players. And this one's small enough to do that, so I guess we have the ability to do what you're saying. Let's go in and make an incision here and a little brain surgery, I guess, and offer this. I'm not saying I'm necessarily opposed to it or in favor of it. I just thought it was kind of unique.
Mr. Hoffman.
To follow up on that, you said that the interest rate's going to drop from 8 to 6% if they...
Our standard rate is 8% right now, and so if it's 2% reduction, put it at 6.
So basically what we're doing is subsidizing further subsidizing the program by giving them the additional 2%. And I would agree with Representative Sun. It seems as though since we are playing banker here, this is not a very good banking decision. And another reason, I guess, why the state shouldn't be in the banking business.
Well, I would, Mr. Chairman, I'd say we're not, I wouldn't call it subsidy. You're foregoing an opportunity to make some money on that. That's on the theory that the state actually makes intelligent decisions on how to invest its money. I would venture to say a large part of our budget and capital budget will not have any rate of return on it after we invest it. So getting 6% on this is better than we're going to get on some of our other investments.
One more chance here. Mr. Davidson.
Well, I'll defer to the wishes of the chair.
All right, I'd like to let the department make comments on the final section of the bill if they didn't cover yet and hear from some of the farmers.
Okay.
Section D.
Section D. To provide the incentive, the board shall restructure the debt of any dairy farmers. What we've been doing is we've been looking at basically income and expense, cash flow of the operations statewide, not just dairy farmers. And we restructure those that are in financial trouble, and we don't restructure those that are not in financial trouble. Of the operations on Point McKenzie, the seven that produce more than 30,000 pounds of milk per month, I would expect that we would probably not restructure two of those operations. One is in a Chapter 11 right now, and the other one has been referred to the AG's office. I believe.
Let me stop you right there just for a second. Now, there's eight farms out there. So of the seven.
The seven that qualify, because
okay.
The other does not.
All right. So of those seven, two are. Go ahead. Walk through those numbers again.
Two probably. Will not survive the year, and that's based on what we're looking at in terms of their milk production, their income, their expense. As I mentioned, one operation went into Chapter 11 last July, and the other operation was recently referred to the Attorney General's office for collection with the offer that the individual could deed back their assets in lieu of foreclosure. We have four that I would classify as a mid-range group. One of those may not succeed, but I would certainly think that two or three years will tell for sure. Three of the other ones probably have a better chance, and then we have two at the top that are financially well-backed, well-managed, well-run operations, and their biggest claim to fame, as it were, would be that they have the financial backing to run the program without more money from the state. And so they are a couple of the top producers of Point McKenzie. And so basically this section of the bill would benefit, I believe, those two producers, because the other seven will fall within a range of not making it anyway.
Let me make sure I understand that. So if you've got eight, you automatically eliminate one.
One, he doesn't produce.
Seven, okay, you got seven farmers, you got some at the top, some at the bottom. The ones at the top, you suggest they have the financial resources available that they probably wouldn't need restructuring in order to continue. And then the ones at the pardon the phrases if they're offensive to anyone, but at the bottom, you've got people that, wouldn't you be required to restructure their debt as well?
Yes, I would.
But
I would not, in looking at the financials, when you restructure their debt, they still have to make loan payments under the program, and if there's not sufficient income to service that debt, then you don't do them a favor. You restructure, then you let them miss three payments out of five, and then you foreclose anyway.
So the restructure, really, I mean, the word shall, of course, has been sort of the center of attention here. I think, did they change that from May on the Senate floor?
Yes, they did.
So there you had one situation, but it does, if you still have discretion as far as how you restructure.
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
So you could offer up under this here, you would be required to restructure my loan.
Right.
And even with your restructuring, I still can't make my payments. So what does that do for me?
Nothing. It just pushes off your foreclosure for another 120 days or maybe 8 months or 9 months until it gets through the process. But if you can't make the payments, obviously you can't make the payments.
Okay, and I guess that Mr. Sun's argument would go for the people, if you will, at the top, the ones that are able to survive without restructuring. Their loans are at the rate they originally agreed.
Well, we would roll those two.
Although they'd be eligible for that 2 points off if they made the timely payments.
They'd be eligible for the 2 points off, and we could write them for 30 years, and we had previously only done them for 25 years, and so $1 million loan, I believe, over 30, amortized over 30 years at 8 would require payments, I think, of about $88,000 a year or thereabouts. If we restructured that same credit, the payment would be $54,000 a year, including interest.
So if you went from 25 to 30 and from 8 to 6 on $1 million, it'd go from 88 to 54, is what you're saying?
Well, if we restructured the loan under our current program, which is 20 years and some of it accrual and some of it non accrual, $1 million loan would yield about $54,000 a year. The total payback if we restructured this particular $1 million example over 30 years would be $1,080,000 to the state. If we just rewrote the loan at 8% over 30 years, we would get about $2.6 million back over term. Difference. So it's a difference for those two producers.
Will you put together some charts for us?
Certainly.
Just to get so we can have some examples of, you don't have to use it, you know, use a million or whatever another typical loan might be, just so we can get some graphics to be looking at for Senate peers.
Well, we've talked about the two lows and the two highs, but what about the four and the mid-range that you described as a mid-range, and which one may not be the three, probably will. Is this restructuring going to substantially help those four? Because I think ending up with just two sound dairy farms certainly doesn't make any sense.
It will. We've already approved one of those in the mid-range for restructure, and it does substantially help him. It makes it possible for him to survive and have some margin, fairly positive margin of cash flow in his operation. He, again, also has some off-farm income to supplement his operation and the extra needs that he has. The other, it depends on management. It depends on how well they do. You know, it's a gamble at best in the middle. But I know that we've done one, and his numbers look really good, and he's been one of the people making payments to us out there on his operating loans every month, and he's really working at it. The other three, we haven't got into all the specific numbers yet. We haven't received some of the information from the growers that we need to do the complete analysis that should be done. Because we do a very in-depth analysis of income and expense in the operations and look at the management equipment and ask them for a five-year plan of what they intend to do in terms of expansion or not expansion in the future.
Well, I guess this is obviously real subjective, but are you comfortable with the dedication of those four mid-range groups or people who are where they are, and I don't know who they are, do they want to make this move?
I
realize how subjective.
Yes, I think they do. I think they want to make it work.
By the way, just in the interest of disclosure, I grew up in Palmer and know some of these people. But don't have any financial interest in any of these farms. By the way, you got three farmers off the point, as they say.
Yes. One of those borrows money from us. We just rewrote a loan to him, for him. It was.
So the other two aren't?
Are not borrowers, no.
All right. So I guess now, what the department's position on this shall, may, business, what's the department's position?
Prefer may.
Prefer may, but if you had a shall in there, you feel that the people that weren't making any otherwise...
The only difference the shall does is we are required to restructure and under our guidelines that we've adopted or in revised guidelines that we may adopt. And so basically it's a loss of opportunity income of maybe $2 million for the loan fund over a 30-year period. That's how it comes down.
So again, if we can get some charts here to put that into perspective for us non-farmers, it would be pretty helpful.